There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. There's a better world, it's a coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world, it's a coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network News Director, and have we got some stories for you tonight. In addition to tonight's theme, looking back at 2013 in the rearview mirror, we have special guests, Dennis Campbell, Anthony Knoll, Gwen Holden Berry, Hans Meyer, Steve Horn, Luis Cuevas, and they'll be giving us their take on some of the important stories of the past year. But first, this news. An important news story out of the Cayman Islands in Costa Rica. The U.S. has signed an agreement with the Cayman Islands, and those countries' banks will comply with anti-tax evasion laws starting next year. More news. Ethnic cleansing of the Negev by Israel. More than 50 public figures in Britain, including high-profile artists, musicians, and writers, have put their names to a letter opposing Israel's plan to forcibly remove up to 70,000 Palestinian Bedouins from their historic desert land, an act condemned by critics as ethnic cleansing. The letter published in The Guardian is part of a protest on Saturday in Israel, Palestine, and two other dozen countries over the Israeli parliament's bill that is expected to get final approval by the end of the year. Don't forget, all these stories can be seen in their entirety if you go to averyvoice.com, averyvoice.com. And meanwhile, we get the Chambers brothers in the background saying, hey, time has come today. TPP in the secret courts. Last week, the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement leapt from behind closed doors negotiations to the front pages of major newspapers, thanks to information from WikiLeaks, revealing previously unpublished details of the proposed intellectual property chapter of the deal. If you haven't heard about TPP, well, there's a reason for that. Not even members of the U.S. Congress have been allowed to see the negotiating text. Thanks to a series of leaks, we're beginning to see glimpses of just exactly how dangerous the agreement is. The WikiLeaks revelations have shown an urgent public light on the agreement's onerous implications regarding private property. More news. Transylvania anti-frackers. Do you think they're about to have sex? One activist whispers. In Transylvania, in central Romania, couched in the bushes with a bunch of hardcore anti-frackers in balaclavas, they are spying on a car that's crept to a halt close to where we're hiding. No, it must be cops. You can see the light from their mobile phones, he says. Been an hour since the group started trashing equipment owned by the gas exploration company Prospectiuni, playing a game of cat and mouse with the security teams and police vehicles that are now sweeping the hilltops looking for the activists. And now, in Fukushima news, the Japanese have come up with the perfect solution. They're going to be able to solve Fukushima with one stroke of the pen. None of this tedious science stuff that, oh, it's just so hard to explain. What they're going to do, state secrets bill. Hey, there you go, you just outlaw the news. State secrets bill meant to suppress Fukushima news. Japan's public is stunned. Citizens could face years in prison. Man has his mouth stuffed with cloth after voicing opposition. Toxic leak into the ocean seems unstoppable. Therefore, the government must plug the information instead. Mainichi, November 27, 2013, the ruling coalition's ramming of a controversial special state secrets bill through the House of Representatives on November 26 has stunned the public. It could discourage citizens as well as journalists from seeking access to such information for fear of harsh punishment. Can't solve the problem? Outlaw the news. There we go. Hey, under the bill, ordinary citizens who aid and abet or conspire with others to leak information classified as special state secrets, and we know who they are, could face up to 5 years in prison, even if the information wasn't actually revealed. No news is good news, huh? The Japanese government, which has already a long history of cover-ups and opaqueness, is on its way to becoming less open and less transparent after the lower house, the Diet, Japanese parliament, passed the designated secrets bill on Tuesday. Designated secrets bill. That's the code word of today. The designated secrets bill. Even politicians inside the ruling bloc are saying it can't be denied that its main purpose is to muzzle the press, shut up whistleblowers, and ensure the nuclear disaster at Fukushima ceases to be an embarrassment before the Olympics. Who cares that you glow at night when, after all, hey, the news is illegal to even know whether you release it or not. Okay, and further in the news, there's just so much news. The hits just keep on coming. Strange doings in the Pacific. It began with anchovies, mile after mile after mile of them in the waters of Monterey Bay. Then the sea lions came by the thousands. The pelicans, the bottlenose dolphins, and groups of 100 more have been spotted. But it was the whales that astounded even longtime residents. More than 200 humpbacks, and on a recent weekend, a pod of 19 rowdy orcas. The water in every direction roiled with mammals. For almost 3 months, Monterey and nearby coastal areas have played host to a mammoth convocation of sea life that scientists here say is unprecedented in their memory. Never that anyone remembers has there been such many, or have they stayed so long. Last month, so many anchovies crowded into San Cruz Harbor that the oxygen ran out, leading to a major die-off. Hey, major die-off. He's probably illegal, too. Just a few weeks ago, similar sightings were reported along Canada's Pacific coast. Vancouver Sun. An extraordinary string of recent whale encounters around Vancouver Island is likely due to luck. Not one feature expert say. There's been a riot this typical year, said John Ford, head of the Cetacean Research Council at the Pacific Biological Station in Nanaimo. The biggie of the bunch is the endangered North Pacific right whale spotted twice in B.C. waters. For the first time in 60 years. There have been other remarkable whale encounters. Passengers aboard the BC ferry between Galeano Island and Tiswassen were treated to the sight of a super pod of about 1,000 Pacific white-sided dolphins. well, they can't afford safety, so at least we can't afford to know what's going on. With the first plume of water carrying radionuclides from Fukushima due to hit the U.S. coast any day now, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute senior scientist Ken Boosler's latest project is to convince the federal government, you know, to monitor it. Hey, what do you say? He predicts radiation will be so diluted after the long journey across the Pacific it will pose no threat. But he knows that that's not enough to assure the public. He knows people are concerned. He fields regular phone calls from surfers and salmon fishermen, as well as congressmen. Hey, how about that? But ladies and gentlemen, we have our first guest, the illustrious, the incomparable, live from Tallahassee, Mr. Hans Meyer. Hans, what's the good news, sir?
Good evening, Rick. Lots of interesting things going on here in Tallahassee. We've had a very interesting year. I think that a lot of the things that have happened on the national stage are foretelling what I am hoping will be a very good year for progressives here in Florida. Of course, looking back, we always want to try to learn from history. Looking back to the government shutdown of 1995, when Republicans, the new majority Republicans, were sort of figured that they were going to take down President Bill Clinton, went to war, if you will, and shut down the government. Well, what happened was, not only was Bill Clinton reelected, but the midterm election following that, which is usually the six-year midterm in a two-term presidency, is usually not very good, actually turned out pretty darn good for the Democrats. And I'm expecting similar things on a national level coming up in 2014. But I think for here in Florida, it's going to have a special effect as far as the governor's mansion is concerned. You've got an incumbent Republican who, quite frankly, is not very popular, who has done a lot of things that have pleased his base no end, but has turned off a lot of Floridians left and right. And when you throw in the, quite frankly, insanity of Republicans on the national level, and I'll be frank with you, I think it's going to be very difficult for a lot of even ultra-conservative Republicans to be able to distance themselves from the lunatic fringe. And, obviously I'm talking about the Ted Cruz's, and I'm talking about the Sarah Palin. I'm talking about that Louis Gohmert from Texas, and I'm talking about Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, and I'm talking about King from Iowa. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And quite frankly, if I were even a relatively moderate Republican, such as our agricultural commissioner or even our chief financial officer, I would be concerned. Now, I don't see that the Democrats are going to be putting up much of a fight on those two fronts, but I would suspect that whether it's Man Rich or Charlie Crist, I think there's going to be a run for the money for the governor's mansion here, and I'm rather looking forward to it. So we've got an interesting year behind us. 2014, I think, is going to be a very interesting year in front of us, Rick, and I'm looking forward to being able to provide input from the state capital of the fourth largest state in the union frequently and as often as you'll have me on the air.
Well, you bet, buddy, you bet. Hey, listen, when you look back at the performance of Governor, hey, quick, let's test their blood, Scott, do you think that his sudden finding of education as a cause, do you think this is going to turn around educators and smile genially on what is soon to be, hopefully, former Governor Scott?
Well, bear in mind, let's face it. Any time a Republican, a conservative, especially an elected or someone running for elective office who presents themselves as a conservative Republican, talks education, what they're talking about is the complete destruction of the public school system in America. Nothing short of that. Look at the meme that is ever present, and I'm ashamed to say that even our own president has said this from time to time, the failure of the public education system in America. Overlooking the fact that while you can anecdotally point to this school or that school or this school district or that school district and see horrible things happening, the truth is that millions and millions and millions of Americans have successfully gone through the public school system, have graduated from it, have gone on to be doctors and lawyers and, quote, job creators and politicians and teachers and on and on and on. So anytime I hear a Republican embrace education, and especially when you're talking about people like the supposed moderate of the Republicans running for president in 2016, Chris Christie, anytime you hear them talk about education, what they're really talking about is not only destroying the public education system, but ensuring that their pals get tax dollars, local, state, and federal tax dollars into their pockets instead of in going towards educating America's students. And so you asked the question, will that all of a sudden turn on educators to Rick Scott? I would hope that the expression, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, goes a long way towards people ignoring this last-minute conversion of a Rick Scott.
Well, I think you've got to the crisp of the matter, that's for sure. Thank you so much, Hans.
Enjoyed it, my friend, and like I said, looking forward to a robust and fun and enjoyable 2014. Have a great evening, Rick.
Thank you, brother. Let me predict, I can see in my crystal ball now, you're going to be a regular commentator on the show in 2014. Thank you so much, Hans.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Okay, now direct from the UK, our friend, publisher of the UK Progressive, and executive producer and host of Worldview on YouTube, Mr. Dennis Campbell, direct from Wales.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Dennis Campbell, editor of the UK Progressive magazine, host and senior editor of the YouTube show Worldview. That's at youtube.com/worldviewshow. Dennis, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dennis, it's our pleasure, believe me. You bring such an insight and fresh perspective from across the water. Well, we're talking about today's show, the big stories of 2013. You sent me your top five. You mentioned, for example, the Iranian nuclear discussions and, of course, the new moderate leader in Iran. How do you think that's playing in that interesting marriage of desperate convenience between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Sort of thrown a monkey wrench in their march toward war, hasn't it?
Well, it is, and let's just say that when you say the term moderate president, please always use that with parenthetical reference, because this is a bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing, and Dr. Rouhani has been around for quite some time. He's been a member of the Inner Circle for quite some time. He's a leading cleric, and I think what has happened is that the decades of sanctions have finally begun to take a bit of a bite there. And really what's happening now is you're seeing a bit of desperation, because financially Iran is in tremendous trouble. They're really not that interested in giving up their nuclear program, but they are very interested in, making sure that the sanctions are lifted. Now, the interesting thing about this is that we hear President Obama, the allies, and others, including France, who threw a monkey wrench into the current talk, saying that they will not sign a bad deal, that verification and stoppage of a nuclear program must come before the release of any sanctions. But the monkey wrench that came up just yesterday was the defense minister, and I forget his name, but part of Netanyahu's cabinet, mentioned yesterday that if they feel the U.S. and the West have gotten a bad deal, they may attack anyways. So this is a bit of a dance of the dinosaurs in a region that has seen an awful lot of war and an awful lot of problems. Iran is known as the troublemaker of the region anyways. They will do anything at any time to upset the apple cart. They're very, very big in terms of their influence in the Iraq government of Prime Minister Maliki. They're very, very big in terms of being instigators of problems inside Jordan, where, 2 million refugees have crossed into that country and literally threatened collapse of that nation. They're very, very interested in having a bigger role in Egypt, particularly when the Muslim Brotherhood were in control. So they are on this expansionist program in the region, trying to bring a version of Islamic teaching that is very theoretical and very clerical in nature, so that there's really no chance of these countries having anything but a clerical government, as you have in the religious government there in Iran. The whole Middle Eastern equation has been pretty much held up by the belligerence of Israel. They continue to expand, they continue to build settlements into these disputed territories that they're likely going to hand over at some point, or have to in any two-state solution there.
In terms of press issues, we've had a very curious year for the press. I'm thinking especially in the commercial press's relationship with the spilling of secrets and the uncovering of the kind of a ubiquitous big ear on all our telecommunications that we've heard from Chelsea Manning and now Edward Snowden. And, of course, this has taken some interesting turns in the UK. We had the British intelligence people come and insist that was The Guardian destroy some hard drives, despite the fact that anybody with any technical knowledge knows that destroying a hard drive in one place when files are stored on what passes for the cloud is not even a charade. It's a sad little pantomime.
Yeah, it is, and you know, the whole Edward Snowden case, it continues to unravel. And what's been interesting to watch over the course of the year is that, you know, when this stuff first started coming out in April or May, whenever he was first discovered and fled to Hong Kong, you know, the right and everybody were quick to jump up and including the administration, and say he's a traitor, et cetera, which is what they do in every case where sources and secrets are leaked. The interesting thing is that over time, now we're beginning to see that there are so many areas in which the government overstepped its bound. And because everyone was so involved in Syria and everything else that was going on, a lot of the revelations that were coming out in a timed fashion by him were completely ignored. Now, I'm not ready to brand him a hero by any respect of the imagination, nor am I ready to brand him a traitor. What he's done is he's broken a law, but it's a law that prevents any information from ever being disseminated, no matter if it is to point out that the government is indeed breaking the law. So he's caught in a bit of a catch-22, and I think it takes a lot of courage to stand up and say something in that instance. But what's more importantly is that you sit there and you look at these people, you know, the journalists that are inside that Beltway White House bubble, and the things that they grab onto. And then I watch several of them, like Ed Henry and Major Garrett and others, doing their stand-ups outside the White House and chatting with them, you know, one-on-one and having these conversations to say, you know, why is it that these are so important? Because the rest of the world doesn't care about any of this stuff. Why are you placing so much on, you know, I wrote an article last week in UK Progressive on, you know, healthcare.gov 1.0 versus iOS 7.0. You know, when iOS 7 came out 2 months ago, you would have thought it was the end of the world. People shrieked, they screamed, et cetera. My sister had the best perspective on that. She said, you know, I'm not going to be Apple's test subject. When they get to version 0.0.3 or 0.0.4, I'll download it then, because by then the bugs will all have been worked out. Well, you're seeing the same thing with healthcare.gov. You're seeing that, you know, it is a major rollout of a major computer system, and I don't care where you are or what business you're in, a major rollout of any computer system is going to have glitches and bugs and foul-ups and, you know, in some cases, just like we're seeing here, you're going to need to go back to the drawing board. And the hypocrisy of the GOP to say, you know, because of this, people are losing their insurance, when they don't care that 44 million people have no insurance whatsoever, was just astounding. And it was astounding to watch while I was there. I was there, you know, the end of October during the World Series as well. And it continues to astound me, the number of GOP people lining up now in outrage that Obamacare is not working. Now, the website's not working, but every other part of it's working pretty damn well. It actually has a pretty good future, you know, as far as, it's not perfect, but it's a good starting point.
We've seen an unprecedented, basically legislative gridlock since the election of Mr. Obama. Unprecedented number of candidates for office just turned away and not processed whatsoever. And now with the adjustment of Senate policies to a straight majority, which is hyperbolically called the nuclear option. What's your take on that whole Republican obstructionism versus now going to a simple majority to get candidates through the Senate?
I mean, this is the one thing on this side of the pond that we look at and we think this is the most ridiculous thing we've ever seen. I mean, the purpose of the opposition is to raise a spirited opposition, to raise issues and to have discussions. But to think that they can also somehow suspend mathematics, it's unbelievable. Nobody would ever think to try and do that here. I mean, you either have, you know, a majority of a number of votes, and you have a whip who goes out and counts and makes sure you have the right vote before they bring something forward, or you don't. And that's the end of the debate. I mean, these are arcane Senate rules. And from my understanding, it used to be much, much worse. It used to be 70 votes before you could avoid cloture. Now, you know, we're down to 60. Now we're down to, on nominations only, you can have, you know, a 51-50 or 51-49 majority is all that's required to win. It just astounds me some days to watch the workings of this Congress. They've done absolutely nothing in the course of the last 5 years. They blame the president for everything. They say it's not racial. They say it's not anything else. But you look at the facts, the figures, and the way things line up, and they just haven't got used to the idea that a black man not only won the presidency, he won it twice. And you've really got to wake up and say, okay, folks, you know, this man has the authority to appoint judges. You may not like the judges, but he has the he has the ability to appoint ambassadors and people to head up agencies and whatever. And, you know, if it's the law, you do it, full stop. And I just don't understand the way the obstructionists, particularly Senator McConnell, have been able to keep this going for 5 years. I'm really glad that Harry Reid finally grew a pair and got out there and did something to get rid of it.
If you were going to break out your gazing stone or your crystal ring and look ahead into 2014, what do you think are some of the pressing issues in this beginning part of 2014?
Well, you know, both of our countries are going to be involved in election campaigns in 2014. You know, so you're going to see a lot of jostling for position. You're going to see a lot of blame going on. I think that, you know, President Obama will come back from all of this healthcare.gov nonsense, and people will begin to wake up and see that people are being covered, and that, yes, few people that have lost those substandard healthcare programs will continue to make some noise, but on the whole, you know, you're going to see a huge spike in the number of people that are being taken care of and are insured, and that will move forward without problem. I mean, the biggest issue right after the first of the year is going to be the fact that you're not going to have a budget deal. You're not going to have the debt ceiling raised. I think you're going to see the Republican Party, despite their protestations, once again shut the government down, and they may even actually default on the debt this time. They're determined to punish this president, and in so doing, they will take the economy down with them, and I don't understand that. I mean, I do not like David Cameron. I respect the fact that he is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and I don't like his government, yet I would not do anything, nor could I see any political party going to the lengths of the GOP Tea Party to stop him. You stop him at the ballot box. You stop him by getting people to turn out. You stop him in the election, which will happen here in May of 2015, but the campaigning has already begun as of the first of the year. In your country, you're going to have your midterm elections. The deck is stacked very much against the Democrats being able to take control of the House, but you never know what will happen. I think as they continue to obstruct and do nothing on immigration reform and do nothing on any of the major problems that are out there, it could be a very difficult side for them, particularly if they shut the government down at the beginning of the year.
Two other things I'd like to mention or get you to talk about. One is the ongoing troubles in Egypt. The Mubarak trial seems to be on hold. Morsi trial, I haven't heard too much about that in a while. I was speaking to someone from Egypt, and they said, boy, the economy's really perked up. Any final comments on what you see going on in Egypt?
Egypt has gone from bad to worse. You know, we interviewed a man in Minneapolis who's a frequent contributor to our program, and we also interviewed his niece, whose brother is being held in prison since the Morsi uprising. it is something that is very real, and it is something that is going to continue to be a problem. I think most telling, I read an item yesterday in the news that Holland America Lines and one other major cruise line, because of the turmoil, have ceased having cruise ships stop there.
Oh, my.
Now, tourism is such a huge part of what goes on in Egypt, and the continued turmoil and the economic impact of people not, you know, basically coming, you know, thousands of people coming off of these ships into Cairo and Alexandria and other, you know, port cities and spending money is going to be devastating. And the economy is still the ticking bomb out there. That I think that there's another public uprising coming in that particular country. Syria has devolved into outright civil war, and there's no end in sight for that. God only knows what will happen. And then, you know, you've got the instability that continues between the Palestinians and the Israelis. You've got Iran, you know, all the things we talked about at the top of this show that are going to continue to be an issue moving forward. But I think Egypt has, you know, General Sisi is trying to do the right and moderate thing. The problem is, will the Muslim Brotherhood, the people that supported it, go along with him, because they are now a powerful force? The problem is, will the, you know, other people and other religions, the Coptic Christians, will they go along with it? Will women get rights back again? Will the military ease its stranglehold on the government? All of those are to be determined. It's really going to be a nasty situation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Dennis Campbell, UK progressive publisher and also the senior editor of Worldview on YouTube. Thank you so much, Dennis.
My pleasure.
Take care.
I want to thank our fellow broadcasters. It's a regular feature of our show that we always want to remind you that there are other good progressive broadcasters out there telling you the tales you need to know, interviewing progressives from across Florida and beyond. So I want to mention these good progressive broadcasters: Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Biguil and her show Sita Media, Harriet Lerman and her show The Voice of the People, and our good friend Rob Abison and his show Smile, It's Only Politics. And now for some more news. A church group trying to feed the homeless has been ordered to stop. This is from Lake Worth, Florida. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone, but apparently not for the homeless in Lake Worth. This holiday is supposed to be a day to think of others, which is exactly what the church members from Acts 2 Worship Center in Loxahatchee wanted to do. But when the small group tried to deliver food to the homeless living at the park ranger ordered them to stop. God takes care of us, said Steve Griffin, who's homeless. We don't starve. We're grateful. Griffin and his wife, Dominique, have lived at the John Prince Park in Lake Worth for years, and they're not the only ones. You get all these other people coming in, said Griffin, as his wife nods in agreement. I guess it's because of the economy. For that reason, a dozen church members like Teresa Del Rio from Acts 2 showed up with packaged Thanksgiving meals. We can do a lot of mission trips and help the homeless and stuff like that, said Del Rio. I do whatever I can. We brought our kids out here so they could see what it's really like for people that are struggling, said church member Brian Oakes. This is an act of kindness, and it's greatly appreciated. We're grateful, you know, Kevin Rudd said, who's also homeless. They hand out, we meet the guys and stuff, they give us prayers and everything. But just then, as homeless like Kevin were being fed, a Palm Beach County park ranger came up to the church group and ordered them to stop and leave. Everybody just went, huh? Said a confused Rudd. This is very disappointing, said Ryan. So Channel 12 News walked around Prince Park, followed the church members who just wanted to deliver the remaining Thanksgiving packages. This despite being told by the park ranger they had to leave or be ticketed. Thank you so much, said the family receiving the food. Mr. Park Ranger, said CBS 12 reporter Israel Balderas, how are you, sir? CBS 12 tracked down the park ranger that witnesses said was kicking the church members out. I'm not allowed to talk with you, said the park ranger. Ah, more of that public affairs by silence. Is also identified as Mark. You have to take your questions to the administration building. They're saying that you told the church people to leave, said the reporter to the park ranger. Hi, said the park ranger to the camera. I can't talk to you. My bosses don't want me to talk. Park Ranger Mark said he was ordered to warn the church members that they were violating county ordinances when he was asked to cite the specific law that gave him the authority to kick out church members from a public park. He couldn't do it, so he called dispatch to ask for help. The previous activity was being referred to was the ranger telling the church group that they couldn't feed the homeless. CBS 12 was told only the director of the parks would talk on camera, but he wasn't available. Hey, there we go. He's a catch at the 22. Dispatch said that feeding the homeless was not permitted an activity by a large group. But CBS 12 asked, well, what constitutes an activity and what size is too large? While CBS 12 waited for Mark's supervisor, Max Stewart, to show up at Prince Park, but surprise, surprise, that never happened. By the time CBS 12 finished talking with the park ranger, Acts 2 church members were done passing out the food. The homeless at the park were thankful for the people giving Thanksgiving dinner and thinking of them. Tomorrow they'll be hungry again. If someone tries to feed them, that activity could be a violation of the law. WikiLeaks! And more about that in just a minute. Let me bring on our next guest here. Good evening. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Who's this?
Hey, Rick. It's Tony Knoll. How are you?
Why, Mr. Knoll, how are you, sir?
I'm really good. How are you? I'm glad to hear that you've got some righteous upset going on.
Well, you know, when we have the kind of societies that we have today, when the inconvenient truth is the illegal truth, when the illegal homeless are... better unfed than and dead, that it's time for us to stand up for what we know is right. Anthony, when you look back at the year 2013, what do you think they're going to be remembering of 2013?
Well, there's so much to choose from, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a target-rich environment, if I can quote my old friend Donnie Rumsfeld.
It is indeed. I very honestly, I think the biggest story of 2013 is going to be, illegal wiretaps, spying, Assange, Snowden. It's just completely the places that the security state has gone to are completely out of hand, and of course we're finding out more about it all the time. Although I do think that I'm hopeful at least that another big story in hindsight is going to be one that just broke in the last week. While I consider myself, when people ask me my religion, a recovering Catholic, I still have to feel a certain measure of pride for what the new pontiff had to say last week about the current state of the world and the best way to repair it. So I'm feeling hopeful that maybe 10 or 20 years from now we'll look back and say that that was kind of a watershed moment when the leader of one of the world's largest religions essentially espoused a socialist approach to solving the problems of capitalism.
He's really picking on some major league scabs there, isn't he? I mean, talking about investigating the Vatican Bank. He's talking about he actually noticed the poor. My goodness, that bishop in Germany really picked a bad time to redo his bathroom, didn't he?
Yeah, and it really is. All kidding aside, I think it's a really wonderful thing. And again, I'm happy to be a expat of the Catholic Church, but I also feel really, really good about the things that he had to say last week. As far as the security state, I think that pretty much your listeners will agree that most of what I have to say about it probably goes without saying. But it is nothing short of criminal that the supposed champion of free and open societies is behaving like anything but.
Well, I think the Japanese are breaking new ground. Who would have thought that the way to solve a nuclear crisis is to ban the information about it?
I just saw that. I guess they do, huh? Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I guess when the three-eyed fish start showing up in La Jolla, you know, we'll see what the real effectiveness of that strategy was. But it's a real shame that the state of things right now.
You know, I as you remember, I sent around a list, and whether you're talking about environmental issues, you know, like fracking or Fukushima, or you're talking about civic employment issues like the sudden rebirth of the 99% standing up for themselves at Walmart and at McDonald's, or the collapse of these slave shops over in Bangladesh in the East. It's really amazing. There's a real revolution coming, and let's hope that we win a couple for the 99s, huh?
Absolutely, and I do think it all comes back to transparency. You know, in one way or another, all the things on your list, the things that you just mentioned there, you know, the pivot point on every one of those is transparency. You know, you have the Japanese government trying to hide things. You have our own government trying to hide things. You have big labor unions trying to hide the fact that they're useless. And I think that people are rediscovering the value of transparency and the degree to which it is being limited by the powers that be, and I think that's going to be a common rallying point for people who are out to make a fundamental difference in the world.
Well, Tony, hang in there, buddy. I'm going to bring on another one of our guests, and after we get through the list, we'll be bringing everybody on in kind of a great little round table. So hang in there. We'll be back to you, buddy.
Thanks, Rick.
And welcome. This is a Progressive News Network, 2013 in the rearview mirror. Who do I have here? My new guest.
Gwen.
Gwen Holden Berry, the mistress and producer of Here Be Monsters. Gwen, welcome.
Thank you.
So
it's
tell
good
me,
to be
Gwen.
Here.
It's we're so happy to have you. What's on your hit list of looking back on 2013? What are people going to remember about 2013 in your book?
Well, I think one of the biggest things people are going to remember, I know I will remember that it's such an upside down world. It really is. One day it's wonderful. The next day it's just miserable, more miserable than wonderful. But I took issue with the Pope. And I did say that it looked like a big PR campaign. It's been my opinion. But I have to tell you, I saw a story yesterday on the Pope where he approached a man in Italy who is a very disfigured gentleman who was covered in all of these, their growths. Even myself as a healer, I would be, you know, I would approach and touch the man, but it would be something that would be very hard. I saw a film of this Pope embracing without hesitation this man, and I was stunned. I really was stunned. You expect it. You know, we were raised to expect that a Pope was, this is what he was, but I've grown up in this world and seen the opposite, and yet there he was embracing this man, and I have to say that that is something that I would consider holy, and that's going a long way for me. And on that, I would say there are positive things happening.
Wonderful.
Positive Wonderful. Changes.
How about it? Go ahead.
Israel and Palestine has been a huge issue and not enough attention paid to it. What's going on between Israel and the Palestinians in Israel and what should be partly Palestine? That's been an abused issue, and it's being assigned to being a non-issue, especially with world news. I think that's something very important. And the other thing that I think is the most drastic is, of course, Fukushima.
Oh, absolutely. You'll get a hearty agreement there. when we think about the year ahead, 2014, and we look back at 2013, you know, we think of these things, some of which will be lost in the news, and some of which will linger for a long time. Clearly, Fukushima is one of those issues that's going to linger for some time. If you were to just pick one topic from 2013 that you see is going to definitely linger and experienced a significant change here in 2013, what would you pick?
You mean that change in 2014 from 2013?
Well, what I was thinking was something that happened in 2013 that's going to be with us, and we're going to think back to those changes in 2013. It's going to be carried with us for a long time.
You know, I think I'm going to answer this as an American, and I'm going to say that of all of the things that have happened, because there have been so many, it's just that time where we're walking into a new aeon. But I think the one thing that that stands out in my head is the failure of the Obamacare, the new health insurance act. Its failure and the decline of policy within the Obama administration. I think that something actually happened that could be a real stain on the whole presidency. I think it could cast a pall over it.
Thank you. Let me go ahead and bring on our next guest, and if you can hang in there, Gwen, we're going to have a round
table
toward the end. Okay, thank you, dear. Let me bring on our next guest. I want to welcome Luis Cuevas. Luis, welcome, sir.
Hello, Rick. How are you?
Very good, my friend. I hope the holidays were good to you and good to all my guests. Luis,
yeah.
When you look back, sir, at 2013, what are some of the big stories that you think are going to be remembered?
There's two big stories that I've been looking at, and they've been going on for the longest period of time. One of them is the job crisis, which we continued to do nothing about. And that means that we get millions of people who have not had a job for years now. And if they find a job, it's going to be part-time, underpaid. Many of these people, the longer you are, in fact, it's a proven case, that the longer you are out of a job, the worse it will get for you, because then you will take jobs that are not in your area of knowledge or craft, and you will be asked by employers, well, why didn't you work on your craft? And it looks really bad on you. And so it piles up. And then once you reach a certain age, then you are no longer desirable. So it piles up and it snowballs. And that is one of the, you know, really serious problems that we have. And if you're looking at the end of the older age folks, many of them who have to go from retirement to work at supermarkets as cashiers, as baggers, and this type of thing, because they have to supplement their income. Now we also have the young people coming out of high school who are unemployed, and they can't, you know, they just can't find a place. In this situation. So that is really a problem when we magnify it beyond the U.S. shores. And in Europe, it's getting to be places where they have between 27 and 50% of young people without jobs, out of school, and then you have masses of older people who have lost their pension plans or getting them cut. So it's a massive war against the working class that has been going on over the last few years. And there's only one culprit for that, and that is the corporate world. that has been added for years. And when we talk about inequality, we're talking about death, because when people do not have the income to supplement their diet, their medicines, and everything else, we find a huge disparity in the lifespan between the people who have money and the people who don't have. And that can get to be as many as 20 years difference. So that means that the wealthy can get to live 83, but a few miles away, or maybe a few feet away, or so on, where you have people of lesser income, their lifespan drops. And if we add to that, the next thing that I'm worried about is climate change. And the news about that is that we're not doing anything about it. That actually we're sitting down waiting for somehow it will either go away, or then we prepare for the after effects, which is really ridiculous. Because by the time that this strikes, you're going to have a real, I mean, everybody says, well, the next one, big crisis, the next Sandy, so on and so forth. Guess what? We had Katrina. We had Sandy. You know, what are we waiting for? And the next one could be even worse. We saw the Philippines, what has happened there. Islands in the Pacific and Alaska are beginning to disappear, go under. Kiribati in the Pacific Ocean with 100,000-plus people, they have to move out. You see, and this is not making the news. I think that is the most... It's absurd and pathetic thing that we're doing in this country. It's like, oh, yeah, the media talks about a meteor maybe striking the Earth. Yeah, sure. You know, what are the odds? You know, but this is one thing that has been working on this planet for the last 30 years. We've had the problem with unemployment in the United States and overseas for over 10, 13 years. What are we, I mean, are we blind? I think that those are the most pathetic, you know, things that I see in 2013 going on 2014.
Well, you brought us some pretty sober topics. I'm going to add just a touch of frivolity, but yet stay in character with what you're talking about when we talk about the crisis of employment. I think that Apple, with its Chinese factories, have given safety net a whole new meaning.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The fact that we have all these folks, working at minimum, I mean, we talk about minimum wage here. We have people not only just in China working for these purveyors of labor to Apple, where these people are, you know, jumping off the windows and committing suicide because they just can't take the hard labor and the conditions in which they work and the poverty in which they work and the little tiny rooms that they have to share. And they come from the villages, you see, outside the big cities to dwell in this hamlet that corporations have. And that is going on. And then you jump over to Bangladesh, which is the same thing except the garment industry, and you have some of the biggest companies like Walmart, you see, that have all these people living at, you know what it is to make $64 a year? That's their wages. They complain, they strike, they demand $100 a year. To be able to make it. And what do they get? They get batons, they get tear gas, they get the police knocking their, you know, busting their heads. So that's what's going on.
Thank you, Luis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to do before Steve comes, I'm going to open up the floor. Now I'm going to run down some of these issues, and I want to get the different takes, because we have a wonderful group here. We've got Tony Noel from NPA. We've got Gwen Holden-Berry. We've got you, Luis. I want to run some of these issues by you and ask you, not so much, you know, just your take on it, but what we might do about it, because I want this to be a positive show. I don't want to just be lamentation. I want to talk to you and raise these issues with each of you, because I know each of you brings a special insight to it. When we talk about the situation for Chelsea Manning and Mr. Assange and Mr. Snowden and so many other whistleblowers, let me go down the list. Tony, what's your take on this? How can we improve the situation for these American whistleblowers?
I'm a firm believer, as you know from some of our prior conversations, Rick, that nothing really changes in this country through the enactment of laws. What changes things in this country is activism and protest. And I think that anything short of that, in support of greater transparency, something I touched on in the introduction,
sure.
You know, that touches on all three of these whistleblowers, as well as this just the security state in general. And I think that until people are willing to get out and make demands of the government that just simply can no longer be ignored, we're not going to see a lot of reform in these areas.
Thanks. Gwen, what's your take on this, my dear?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of it has to do with the education of the public. And the only way that education of the public happens is when, well, everyone you've got on the show tonight and all the rest of the small independent media crowd keeps pushing and keeps putting the word out there and telling the other side of the story. Because, you know, the side that most people hear in big news media and all, MSM, it's all corporate-driven. It's consumerism. What we need to do is bring up the awareness of people of what the truth really is, what are the facts, and in that, guide people to, you know, listening through their heart and not listening through, you know, that group mentality, that herd mentality.
Thank you. And Luis, what's your take on the surveillance state and our whistleblowers? How can we help them? What's our best tactic?
I think that I'm right along with Tony and Gwen that we need to put out the word. We need to, when everything is quiet, we just can simply go out and use every outlet that we have to put out the word about what's going on. I think that there's plenty of people out there who are hooked up in some way, serious folks, that is, who are hooked up to social media in one way or the other, making the best use of it, and to put out the word about what is going on, why it is going on, so you can educate. And people think that, well, you have only 140 characters on Twitter. Wow, you can do a lot with that. Just, you know, just make sure that you point out people to the right place. You use it to teach people. And, you know, things, the word would get around, and sometimes you don't think about it, but you can get hundreds of thousands of people, if not sometimes millions. We've tried it at Progressive Push. Within 2-3 hours, you can hook up to a million people with one message. And if that carries on, you can get a lot done. So I think that we need to think positive and not think in terms of, well, there's nothing we can do. There's always something we can do. And that we can only do a little bit doesn't mean we can't do anything. Just that little bit will help. And that's, you know, that's what we focus on.
Great. Thank you, Louise. I'm going to go ahead and bring on our next and final guest, Steve Horn. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Steve, a blogger with DeSmog Blog and so many of the sources we know and trust, Op-Ed News, Fire Dog Lake, and many, many others. Steve, you know, I've asked all my guests to give me some of the hottest topics that they think are going to linger, the things that people are going to remember from 2013. What is your top five, sir, or top three?
Here we go. I'll give you my top three. The overarching number one is climate change, because it's not going away in 2014. It's not going away anytime ever. I mean, it's the issue of this generation, the next one, and these generations will have to deal with the increasing scary impacts of it that we already saw in the Philippines, for example, with the huge typhoon or other weird weather, super hot summer in China. It's a global issue, and it's not going away anytime soon. So I'd say that's number one. Number two, and then two and three are completely connected. Number two is pipeline issues, energy issues that are causing the climate change. You know, in the United States, there's a big debate over the Keystone XL pipeline and other tar sands pipelines. There's big debates over fracking, and you know, depending on what direction these industries go in, and if they continue to do what they're doing, they're going to continue to make climate change a more severe, scary issue. So I think that's number two. Just the industries on the whole, and I guess what Bill McKibben, they call them rogue industries that are, basically changing the chemical composition of the atmosphere in such a way that it's climate change is just getting to a level where it's at a runaway level. And then number three is the impacts of the spills themselves ecologically, or when the pipelines spill, I should say. And we saw that. We saw, one of the biggest tar sands spills in U.S. history this year in Mayflower, Arkansas, which still the impacts are being felt today by those communities. It's a destroyed community. We see what happened in Michigan even 3 years ago. The impacts are still being felt there near the Kalamazoo River. Where I live, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, not too far from Lake Michigan. It's now being considered a place where tar sands can be transported by barge. So we're talking about these ways of transporting the energy are huge ecological issues if they spill. And even if they don't spill, they are changing landscapes. Forests are having to be clear-cutted. People are getting kicked off their land, that type of thing. So I think these three are interrelated, but I think what trumps all of them is climate change impacts.
Steve, let me ask you this. One of the latest means that they're choosing to attack us is they're going to try to raise the price of protest and basically outlaw protest unless you can post a 5 or 10 or who knows what kind of bond before protest. Do you think this is going to be a successful counterattack to public activism?
I think that's up to activists if they're going to let it become one. I think no one should deny. I mean, it would be silly to deny that is what's happening. That's what happened with the activists down in Texas who've been fighting back against the Keystone XL pipeline. They were, like you said, there was a huge SLAPP lawsuit brought against them earlier on. That happened actually at the beginning of 2013. They had to settle for paying a fine, and if they continue to do what they were doing, they may have gotten an even bigger lawsuit. They were also put on terrorist watch lists, that type of thing. And these are all tactics that the industry and the U.S. government in collusion uses to scare off activism. I think it's up to activists if they to say, is this going to scare us away, or is this a sign that our protest works, that it's striking a nerve, and that we continue doing what we're doing? I think that ultimately it just depends. I mean, it is scary, but so are the impacts of what these industries are doing. So sort of a choice that activists have to make, what do they fear more, the ecological impacts or, sort of the criminalization and just the overall attempt to squelch what they're doing.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Always a
thoughtful discussion. I want to raise this question with the group. It's one of those always interrelated issues that, in my mind, never gets quite enough play. You know, our country has been awfully ready, some might even say eager, to send military troops to whether it be Africa or the Near East or wherever. I want to get you all to weigh in on the ongoing disaster that is the remains of Iraq, the ongoing, although one would hear that the number of drones hitting Pakistan are somewhat reduced, but of course we've got Syria in that whole situation, and of course, as Gwen pointed out, Israel and Palestine. So let me get you to weigh in on that. Tony, let me ask you first, sir. Are we going to be able to successfully pull out of Iraq, or are we destined to be occupying the Middle East like we do North Korea and Germany?
I think we absolutely are. I think that's the end game, actually. I think that what we hear from our leaders about wanting to get out of Iraq amounts to very little more than platitudes that are designed to keep the American people thinking that we are not going to have long-term involvement there, when in fact all signs are already pointing to us, you know, not only having already established that, but intending to maintain it for a long time to come. What we are seeing, I believe, with the United States' perpetual war economy is nothing less than the attempt to create bases in all strategic areas of the world, which the Joint Chiefs of Staff will quickly argue are all areas of the world, in order to justify the positioning of U.S. installations in all areas of the world. I've long said that you can't profit on warfare if the demand for bombs goes away, and the only way to ensure that there's always a demand for bombs is to keep going to war. So I think that we are truly building an economy that is war focused, and that we're going to continue to do that.
Thank you, Gwen. Your thoughts?
I completely agree with what this gentleman has just said. I mean, our gross national product is war. That's what it's become. And staying in, we're sending troops out to countries now in Africa. We're sending troops to, my God, we're going over to Iran now. And of course, that means then we're going to have to back ourselves up more in Israel and in Palestine. And it just goes to follow. So there's no coming home. There's just more going out, because that's how we make our living on a national basis.
We have to change that. Thank you very much. Steve, Middle East, are we permanent occupiers?
Yeah, well, I agree with what everyone said, and I would just add that one trend to keep, I think that a lot of the liberals and the left in general, progressives, tend to miss, is that even if there's no military occupation in a lot of these places, you know, an area of the world that I've looked at a lot where there's not really a significant footprint of U.S. military is Kazakhstan or Central Asia. And I'm not denying anything about the footprint of the military, which is massive and global in nature. And I think, like the first guest said, and there's an attempt to, anywhere there can be a base, there will be a base. As Chalmers Johnson said, it's an empire of bases. But I think one thing to point out is just the concept of soft power, where there's not so much the use of military force, but there's still, a U.S. or Western NATO type of footprint in a country in which they're still trying, the U.S. and the Western countries are still trying to impose their will on a place through other means, such as imposing an education agenda that's, business friendly in that area, or just, trying to shove English in their faces because it's the global language of business, that type of thing. So I think on top of the hard power military presence in countries, one thing that often gets missed is what Joseph Nye called Soft Power in his 1990 article in Foreign Policy magazine. So I think that that's also this, now it's called Smart Power by someone like Samantha Power in the State Department. But it's the same thing, and that's a new push. It's not even
a new marketing.
It's a new marketing ploy, but that's another big trend to look, to look forward to in the coming years. More sophisticated means of coercion abroad.
Thank you, Luis. Sir, as our senior consultant here, are we destined to be occupiers in the Near East?
Unless something really drastic happens, yes. If you think about it, it's been since essentially 1895 when we got in the Pacific. After we had been in the conquest of the continent. We stole half of Mexico fair and square, so we moved out to the Pacific, and then we took some of the lesser islands, and we established a system, of islands, and it was all under the excuse at that time that we needed coaling stations for the steamships. So we extended that into the 1898, when we then wandered about and took, the Caribbean and the Philippine Islands, and all that that happened until 1914. And the Filipino wars were horrible, only that the American system has forgotten about it, but they were really bad. But the end of the story, to make it short, it's, once you establish an empire, you have to pay a price, and you continue through. And right now, the world is divided. Most Americans don't know this, but the United States has divided the world into five CINCOM areas, commander-in-chief areas. They're all military, and they respond to, of course, the commander-in-chief, but in many regional areas like Pakistan, Afghanistan, so on and so forth, the commander-in-chief, the military commander-in-chief of that region is almost like a Roman, what would you call them, the consuls, proconsuls, and that type of thing. And what they do is that they are the ones who, in spite of the Department of State, they deal with the rulers of those countries more directly than Kerry or Mrs. Clinton would have done in the last few years. That means that these sitcom commanders, they have a lot of power. And so, to change this, and we are already hitting, 800 bases throughout the entire world. That itself is a tremendous cost to this country, and but it keeps a whole military industrial complex going, and so unfortunately, that settles this for us.
Okay, thank you, sir. The next one I want to bring up is another area that is interrelated very much in both our foreign and domestic policy, but it's an area we haven't talked about yet, and that is Republican obstructionism. It seems that our legislature and the national, as well as in many, many states, the legislatures, if they're not legislating morality, have decided the best legislative posture is to stop any Democratic bills should any be conceived. And obviously, knowing Democrats as we do, they don't jump out for much. So let's talk about Republican obstructionism. Are they going to pay a price in 2014 or 2016? I want to get your views on this. I'm going to reverse it this time. I'm going to start with Luis.
Okay. Really interesting that the corporate media has already started the horse race. You see, they treat races for Congress and for the presidency just like a horse race, because they want to keep people animated and on top of things. And so they have already started on 2016, jumping over 2014. And one of the things that we've been banging at on a progressive push and hitting our folks and spreading the word out there is vote local. Look at the local elections. Forget about 2016. That hasn't happened yet. 2014 hasn't happened yet. So focus on your local elections right now. Then focus on 2014. Then focus on the next local elections. Don't let the corporate media decide these things for you. Because, in fact, all this obstructionism is meant as halting everything that happens. In the meantime, while everybody is focusing on what the media is saying, at the local level, the Republicans are stealing elections. They are undermining the democratic voting process. They're running all these schemes that people don't realize. And right now we're focusing on getting as many people to get registered to vote, to get active, to show up. It is not about demographics. It's about turning out. And so that's what we're saying to contrast this. Yes, there's going to be more obstructionism. That is, you know, that's not going to change. That's the plan. You cripple this administration until you get to 2016. And you know that you know where you pour the money, but we're saying don't bite into that bait. You see, don't buy it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Let me ask you the same question, sir. Do you see more obstructionism, or do you think they're going to change tactics with this next election coming up?
Sorry, is this for Steve? Are you asking for
yes,
for me
Steve,
now?
Steve,
or okay.
Yep.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was a follow-up for Luis. I think that, I agreed with Luis. I think that what happens in Washington, D.C. is obviously important. I think that obstructionism is definitely the name of the game there. Although there are a lot of important bills that still get passed. Or, you know, one trend I'll just point out at the federal level, then I want to go to the state level for a second. At the federal level, what the GOP is really good at doing right now is pushing forward a lot of, you know, these bills that they know they're never going to pass, but they, you know, they're for propaganda points. So they'll, you know, recently, you know, in my sphere where I look at energy, you know, they're looking at getting rid of the complete federal government oversight of pipeline review for pipelines that cross the Canadian and U.S. border because of the Keystone XL conflict and debate. Well, they don't actually think it's going to pass, but they do this all the time where these super extreme bills, where they just push them forward just so that the idea of this concept gets out to the public, and then, you know, they put out a press release and that type of thing. So I think that you know, that's just an interesting trend that I've noticed happening quite a bit in the age of Obama. The other thing that I find interesting about the whole horse race mentality at the federal level and big name races is that we lose sight of what's happening at the state level with a group like the American Legislative Exchange Council, for example, which is predominantly the Republican Party. And you know, they're able to push through all these model bills in state houses around the country without much oversight because much more ever since the Alec Exposed documents came up from the Center for Media and Democracy. But I think that losing sight of these elections at the state level, basically forgetting that those are happening, is giving them carte blanche to potentially win elections at the state level and push through their, you know, their corporate wish list of legislation that they want at the state level, using ALEC as the vehicle for these model bills. So I think that that's something that I think a lot of people are more aware of now than they used to be. But I think at least the horse race mentality, looking at national level races, is sort of not good in terms of overlooking what's happening at the state level, these very important elections.
Thank you. Gwen, do you think this obstructionism is going to continue? I mean, do you think that's their campaign approach for 2014?
Well, I think that amongst politicians, it's always been that way, to be honest with you. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the huge block that's been going on, but I would digress and go back to the value in what Luis and what the last gentleman just said. Where our enthusiasm should lie is in the local elections and the local, you know, keep it locally sustainable. I think we have much better chances of getting real people elected, party members, independents, people who are not owned by the corporation Republican or the corporation Democrat. And then of course paying attention to who's going to Tallahassee. I think that's the real important thing there. Obstructionism, we allow it going on by voting in wrong people, people who belong to one color or the other instead of the person who's willing to do the job.
Thank you. Thank you. Anthony, sir, Republican obstructionism, the rule of the law of the day, are they going to stay with this stuff? Do you see people turning away from their enthusiastic support of this Republican obstructionism?
Well, not in my state, in North Carolina. Shoes. we've got a real problem here in NC, boys and girls. But let me just first echo everything that your other three guests, Gwen, Louise, and Stephen have said. Yes, obstructionism will continue anytime you're the minority party, and that's the only card you have to play. You're going to play it, and you're going to play it over the top, as Steve suggested, just in order to get some press, some legs in the press. You're going to float proposals that would just never have any realistic hope of getting through, but that also moves the Overton window, and, you know, anybody who's familiar with that concept knows exactly what I'm referring to there. It plays into a longer term strategy of trying to change public minds and getting people to think back, you know, at some point in the future to, hey, you know, this didn't even seem possible before, and now it's starting to happen. And of course, we've all been down that road and seen our share of it. But just speaking purely for my organization, the New Progressive Alliance, what we have tried to do, at our founding, we relied heavily on, the rallying around a national election in order to raise awareness of independent and third-party candidates. But it all starts at the local level. It continues at the state level. In fact, here I'm in Greenville, North Carolina, which is in the eastern part of the state. We have a young guy just about to graduate from university, who's going to be challenging the sitting Republican state House representative. This kid's 22 years old. That's a huge part of it, too. Every poll that you look at right now, the entire swath of people under 30 recognize by all their answers to all polling what a useless system we have under the corporate duopoly, and they're ready to change it. And I think that bodes really well for the future. But in the meantime, we have to navigate, these next 10 or 15 years. And we also have to make sure that those youth are not co-opted by the corporate parties, because that's what those parties do so well. The Republicans are going to continue to obstruct. The Democrats are going to try to look like they're not, although they're just as culpable. And the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, thank you. Tony, you gave me the perfect segue into my next section. I'm going to ask you folks to sit back and listen for a minute. I'm going to play a recent quote from Senator Warren, where she talks about what's going to happen with the idea of retirement, and what's going to happen, and can we protect the safety net? This is Senator Warren on Retirement with Dignity.
A generation ago, middle-class families were able to put away enough money during their working years to make it through their later years with dignity. On average, they saved about 11% of their take-home pay while working. Many paid off their homes, got rid of all their debts, and retired with strong pensions from their employers. And when pensions, savings, and investments fell short, they could rely on Social Security to make up the difference. That was the story a generation ago, but since that time, the retirement landscape has shifted dramatically against our families. Among working families on the verge of retirement, about a third have no retirement savings of any kind, and another third have total savings that are less than a year's annual income. Many seniors have seen their housing wealth shrink as well. According to AARP, in 2012, one out of every seven older homeowners was paying down a mortgage that was higher than the value of their house. Two decades ago, more than a third of all private sector workers, 35%, had traditional defined benefit pensions, pensions that guaranteed a certain monthly payment that retirees knew they could depend on. Today, that number has been cut in half. Only 18% of private sector workers have defined benefit pensions. Employers have replaced guaranteed retirement income with savings plans like 401k plans that leave the retiree at the mercy of a market that rises and falls, and sometimes at the mercy of dangerous investment products. These plans often fall short of what retirees need, and nearly half of all American workers don't even have access to those limited plans. With tens of millions more financially stressed as they approach retirement, with more and more people left out of the private retirement security system, and with the economic security of our families unraveling, Social Security is rapidly becoming the only lifeline that millions of seniors have to keep their heads above water. And yet, instead of taking on the retirement crisis, instead of strengthening Social Security, some in Washington are fighting to cut benefits. Just this morning, the Washington Post ran an editorial mocking the idea of a looming retirement crisis. To make sure that no one missed the point, they even put the words retirement crisis in quotation marks. No retirement crisis? Tell that to the millions of Americans who are facing retirement without a pension. Tell that to the millions of Americans who have nothing to fall back on except Social Security. There is a $6.6 trillion gap between what Americans under 65 are currently saving and what they need to maintain their standard of living when they hit retirement. $6.6 trillion. And that assumes that Social Security benefits aren't cut. Make no mistake, there is a crisis. The most recent discussion about cutting benefits has focused on something called the chain CPI. Supporters of the chain CPI say it's a more accurate way of measuring the cost of living increases for seniors. This statement is simply not true. Chain CPI falls far short of the actual increases in costs that seniors face. Pure and simple, chain CPI, it's just a fancy way to say cut benefits. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has developed a measure of the real impact of inflation on seniors. It's called the CPI-E, and if we adopt it today, it would generally increase the benefits for our retirees, not cut them. Social Security isn't the answer for all of our retirement problems. We need to find a way to tackle the financial squeeze that is crushing our families. We need to help families start saving again. We need to make sure that more workers have access to better pensions. But in the meantime, so long as these problems continue to exist and so long as we are in the midst of a real and growing retirement crisis, a crisis that is shaking the foundations of what was once a vibrant and secure middle class, the absolute last thing we want to do is cut Social Security benefits. The absolute last thing we should do in 2013, at the very moment that Social Security has become the principal lifeline for millions of our seniors, is allow the program to be dismantled inch by inch. Mr. President, the conversation about retirement and Social Security benefits is not a conversation just about math. At its core, this is a conversation about our values. It is a conversation about who we are as a country and who we are as a people. I believe we honor our promises. We make good on a system that millions of people paid into faithfully throughout their working years. And we support the right of every person to retire with dignity.
So there's Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, talking about the retirement crisis. Maybe some of you still have a retirement package. Some of you probably going to rely on 401ks, and some of you may only have Social Security to rely on. What's your take? And let me go back through the list. We'll start with you, Tony. Tony, what's your take on the baby boomer retirement crisis?
I agree with Senator Warren that it's very real. I'm going to try to withhold my other feelings about Senator Warren and where I think she could be doing some of her more effective work. I sure don't think that it's in the Massachusetts delegation. But that being said, she's absolutely right about the crisis. It exists, and it's only going to get worse. I think, however, that you know, speaking about preserving Social Security while it's all well and good does, but it only begins to touch on the real problem, which is stagnant wages in this country. Yes, that, you know, one thing that we have to remember about Social Security is that it's a pay-as-you-go system. Today's beneficiaries are funded by today's workers. So the more that we are paying employees and the more secure our current workforce is, the more secure that makes our retirement, our people who are entering retirement. Everything in our economy is interrelated, and certainly everything in our programs for seniors are related to the vibrancy of our economy. If our economy were in better shape, we probably wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. I think that that we need to put it in context. We need to put it in the context of how we have failed our workers, how we have done that at the bidding of the corporations which own us, and how until we address that inequality, things aren't going to get any better for anyone.
Thank you, Tony. Gwen, your thoughts.
Well, you know, I, for a large part of my life, I wasn't contributing to Social Security. And in the last few years, I have, but I own my own. So I'm pretty much, I'm flying without the kite tail, and I'm going to be a maker for a long time, I think. The thing is that I agree mostly with what Senator Warren had to say. I don't think that Social Security is in jeopardy. I really do think I work as hard as I can to see that people are making the choices, you know, with my votes and my activism, to have people making choices that are going to take away all of this money from military spending and make the country viable for humanity again. That's the only answer I have for that one, really, Rick. You know?
Thank you, dear. Thank you. I understand. Let me go on and take that to Steve.
Yeah, well, what I would say on this general topic of Social Security and cutting social benefits, we as Occupy Club, the 99%, really have to say, what's the 1%? What do they have to do? What are they having to give up? Because there's a lot of talk about tightening our belts and giving up certain things under the auspices of austerity, but I would say that one thing that's almost a non-starter and sort of a taboo to talk about, but it's becoming increasingly appropriate to talk about, is this issue of offshore tax havens that the elite have, that they park a lot of their cash off in the Cayman Islands, they park a lot of their cash in Delaware, they park, and that's not even offshore, it's an onshore, but just in general, the theme of these trillions of dollars that are not being taxed at all, that in a just system would be going to social welfare benefits for normal people. It's not even going into the taxation system at all. So I think before we ever, I mean, I think you know, Elizabeth Warren's right, though. I think she talked about this broader thing that I'm talking about, is that before we have a conversation about whether or not Social Security should be cut, we should really be talking about, are the super elite paying any taxes or are they dodging taxes? And I would say that it's a problem that's only becoming worse, and it's a problem that we need to tackle before we talk about normal people cutting their Social Security benefits and other social welfare benefits.
Thank you. Luis, sir, what's your thoughts on the Social Security situation?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of misinformation regarding that. If you think the Social Security has way over $2 trillion in assets at this time in terms of its funds, its funding. The other one part that nobody wants to talk about is the fact that the government owes Social Security $2.7 trillion that they have been pilfering away from Social Security. So if the government pays, and that's from the total national debt, I mean, actually, Social Security, the government owes more to Social Security than it owes to China. And so, but, you know, that doesn't make the news. The government owes more to American citizens, 62% of the national debt, you see. And another large percentage is intra-governmental agencies owing to each other. The government of the United States owes the Fed $2 trillion. So they're playing with these numbers. They're playing games with this. And the other part of the news that nobody talks about is pension theft. The fact that workers throughout the country have been losing their pensions because cities, counties, state governments have been mismanaging the pension plans of its workers, investing in these really bad deals, losing money, and then they blame the workers because, this pension plans cost too much. You see, and the biggest, now they have their eyes on the Social Security, because if they can kill Social Security, they can write off, $5-6 trillion of the debt. You see, that nobody wants to talk about that. On the other hand, if you talk about the U.S. Postal Service, the next biggest chunk of money out there is over $5 billion in the pensions of federal postal workers that Wall Street wants, and that's what it's all about.
Right.
You know, there's this is a wonderful topic, and we need to do a whole show on it, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there is an argument. Now, of course, it's not going to be made in this economic climate, but there is an argument for what the Social Security plan was supposed to be, which was, in fact, a retirement with dignity that leaves room for younger workers to come into the workplace, and also has a place for seniors to retire at a comfortable income that gives them some kind of decent life and health care.
Yep.
But like I said, that's not for tonight's discussion.
Could I interject one little bit that nobody wants
Absolutely.
To talk about either? Is that
Absolutely.
Social Security is not just about retiring people, it's about the widows, the children of Social Security payers, that if their spouse, the husband or the mother, they pass away, the children until a certain age, 18, they can get money to help support the family.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for remembering that. I want to bring up it's going to be kind of a difficult topic, and some of you may not agree with me on this, but I'm going to talk about a topic that I call the truth deficit. And the truth deficit to me is where the public just doesn't expect an honest answer anymore, whether it be on the we're not spying on you, well, we're spying on you a little, well, we're spying on you a lot. We have the 9/11 Commission. Well, the 9/11 Commission blinked a lot. We didn't really ask all the questions we should, whether it be the Warren Report, the 9/11 Report, the in Britain, where on the, at the same time the intelligence community said to the Guardian, we want you to destroy hard drives because they once held information, knowing full well that the information also lived on the in the cloud, that destroying a hard drive was a pantomime. So I want to ask, what cost are we going to pay from this honesty or truth deficit? And let me go to you, Anthony, first. Anthony, do you see this truth deficit?
Oh, I absolutely do. I think the government has a vested interest in perpetuating it. It's sad to say that, but I do think it's true. I think all of us as journalists have experienced governments or government entities which do not want to come fully clean, even if it's, you know, as something as mundane. I'll give you a perfect example. I co-founded a local online newspaper here in Greenville. It's you know, doing pretty well. It's a nonprofit. We were looking into an issue with campaign signage, and North Carolina has some very clear laws about what size signs can be placed where and when. And this was all relative to the local election, which just happened. And I chased everybody from the state attorney general to the local DA to our police chief. I just got a copy of a letter that he composed in response to my queries about why it was not being enforced for certain candidates. Now, the certain candidate was the sitting mayor. you know, we can bring it right down to the local level, and since our conversation is focused on that a little bit, you know, already, I think it's important that we do that, because as egregious as the violations are at the national and international level, you know, we need to demand transparency from our local governments, because, you know, this is where we live. You know, we all live in the United States, and all of those things affect us, but we also have to look at how this stuff gets started, because the, you know, the police chief, the local police chief of today, is going to, you know, if he pursues a career path, could become the, you know, some muckety-muck with the state or at the federal level tomorrow. So you know, transparency is something that has to be ingrained in officials from the time that they first take the reins of power. And, you know, with most local media now owned by big conglomerates, that just isn't happening anymore, because big conglomerates are mostly interested in keeping their tax their shareholders happy. And so the first thing that gets cut is newsrooms. And when newsrooms get cut, sunshine laws aren't paid much attention. And that's really where it all starts. So I think that the truth deficits will continue to the extent that we continue to fail to educate the public about government's disclosure responsibilities. And until we can start doing that as well as we did maybe 30 or 40 years ago, again, it's just going to keep getting worse.
Thank you. Gwen, what's your thoughts on this? Do you see a truth deficit?
I feel like I'm out of my ken here, because I really think it's so loused up, there's no way back.
Well,
honestly.
Let me ask you this then. What's the impact?
Yeah.
I think there's a terrible impact on the body politic when they just don't expect the truth anymore.
You know, and we're seeing it. We're watching it. It's unfolding right in front of us, isn't it? Really. We think everything is going along well. Okay, that happened, but we're still here at safe as houses. Oh, well, that happened, and we're still here at safe as houses, but things are ebbing away. I noticed something that's very strange, Rick. The stock market keeps getting larger. It climbs higher. It keeps rallying more. And there's something dangerous going on there. And the deficit, well, it's like, was it Luis who said that trillions of money that belongs in Social Security has been pilfered by the government and really probably for mostly military funding? With all of that going on, you know, we're getting closer and closer to some kind of black hole that's opening up here, I think.
Thanks, Gwen. Steve, your reaction to this truth deficit and the impact on the body politic?
Yeah, well, you know, that's always the overarch. That's how I got into journalism and writing, or I would say that's what has informed my writing since I got into it. And I think that, you know, there's an important recent book about this phenomenon called The Propaganda Society by a professor at Portland State University named Gerald Sussman. He edited a bunch of the best minds on public relations and propaganda. And I think it always goes back to what Noam Chomsky wrote in his famous book on the propaganda model and manufacturing consent. You know, we can't ever rely on getting our information from the mainstream media and the corporate media. There's a certain level of depth and scope to their news that they're allowed to put out based on who funds them, which is big corporations, whether it's advertisements or directly being owned by big corporate parents, such as the Washington Post, soon by Jeff Bezos, who has no real public commitment to tackling corporations in any meaningful way. So I think that there's always going to be what they put out, but I think it's up to us, you know, these people on the call, and what you're doing at the Progressive Radio Network and building a project like that to create an alternative media that does speak truth to power and does, you know, get voices on the media that aren't going to be represented by the corporate media. And I think that that's, you know, it's an annual challenge, but I think it's a worthy one because it's these voices that are going to inform people and educate them to rise up and, you know, create a different society. So that's kind of where I'm seeing things.
Thank you, brother. Thank you very much. And Luis, sir.
Yeah, it's no doubt that there is a tremendous problem with the issue of the truth brings down those famous lines, truth, you can't handle the truth. And you know, when you think about it, it's who are all these people who are telling the rest of us that we can't handle the truth, that they know better. That's the problem that we have. And, you know, the question brings to mind a guy by the name of David Graham Phillips, writing way back, I think it was 1905, something like that. He wrote about the treason of the Senate. And what he did was to, in a series of essays, he attacked the fact that the Senate itself was sold out. Nothing new now, but 100 years ago, that was a scandal. And what happens is that Theodore Roosevelt actually coined a phrase when he attacked Phillips for his writings, because he couldn't, you know, you're attacking this body of the U.S. Senate. And he says he came up with the term of muckrakers. And progressives have been doing this. That's our job, to bring out that thing, to dig it out, to bring the truth out to the folks, to the people, and to tell them, you know, we're not going to go back. We're not going to sit down. We've been at it for 100 years. We're going to keep on going at it. And, you know, they have the corporate media. Well, we have the independent media. And frankly, we are going to, you know, we're making inroads there. Because, you know, working on it on a daily basis, I think that there are some bright lights out there that are beginning to shine, you know, from coast to coast. And it's from Canada to Britain. It's, you know, throughout very many places that people are now beginning to communicate in ways that they couldn't before. is a independent of the corporate media, and we need to use that. That's the good news. But we have to be watchful about all these ploys to actually censor the Internet and knock it out at any given time. That's what we need to be worried about.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. I want to bring up another, unfortunately, very unpleasant issue. There's a lot of rumors swirling around that Scott Walker of Wisconsin is going to be running. And since he is the ALEC-designated destroyer of public unions, I want to ask my thoughtful guest tonight, how can we oppose this destruction of the civic union, of the public union? And I'm going to start with you, Luis. You've been in this battle for a long time, sir.
Yeah. We've been fighting that one. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, give us some words of wisdom on this, sir.
Well, one of the things is we have connections over in Wisconsin. They're fighting this. And you know that right now there's a huge investigation on Scott. And there's a lot of dirt in there. I think that he's trying to get, and the media, again, is part of this horse race, that they're putting it out in between, we got now, him in the Wisconsin, and we got, Christie in New Jersey. But who is going to get where? And so we line up the horse race. Now, in between is what you mentioned. In there is that both candidates, and it doesn't matter who it is, every Republican who is out there running for office is out to destroy public unions. It doesn't matter where they are. It doesn't matter what they're running for. The main goal is to destroy the unions, because they know that that's the obstacle that keeps democracy going, and it's the obstacle to their power basis. And so that's where we need to work with, strengthening the unions and getting the word out and combating all the negative media, corporate media attacks on the unions. But I think that there is a red herring there, because they want to focus on these guys and not tell us what is going on. And if you go to Detroit, if you go to Chicago, you go to one of the, New Jersey, and so on, and sometimes in some cases there are even Democrats who are in there, and they're working against the unions.
Yeah.
So it's our job to put out the word about that, and not to focus so much on these guys. Because, again, I mean, we have, I'm telling people, we had the clown car running in 2012. Well, now there's so many of them that we have a clown van. You see, there's so many, and it keeps growing. So in size, it's almost like, that every village idiot since George W. Bush has decided that they want to come out and be governors and presidents and members of Congress. It's perhaps the revenge of the village idiots. you can make a movie out of that. I think that the media really manipulates this a lot to their own use. The characters in this theater performance, they will come up and down. Barry is still around, and so on, and somebody will pull Palin out rabbit bag. So yeah, it's all
Thank
that.
You. Steve, do you think the ALEC attack on public unions is going to be successful?
Well, I think that, again, it's going to come down to, can it be exposed? Can people understand that it came from ALEC as opposed to, say, some genius idea such as Scott Walker's brain? I mean, Scott Walker, I just want to go back to him because he is sort of Mr. ALEC here. I mean, he just wrote a book called Unintimidated, A Governor's Challenge and a Nation's Challenge. And a lot of these ideas, when he writes this book, he's acting as if they were his super smart ideas, and he's such a smart guy, and he was unintimidated to challenge these unions and make people buckle their belts a little bit tighter in his push to pretty extreme austerity measures. But, you know, people like Scott Walker, people like all these other governors that got elected in 2010 from the GOP, the water that they carry is the water of ALEC, which is the corporate agenda. And I think it's up to people to continue to inform the public that people like Scott Walker aren't just people that are coming up with these smart their policy ideas. They're just essentially puppets of more powerful factions. In Scott Walker's case, it's the Koch brothers, and it's the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the WMC, which is one of the – it's a state-level offshoot of the United States Chamber of Commerce. So that will be the challenge going forward. It will be important for the people – I mean, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. It will be important for the people of Madison, Wisconsin, to explain who Scott Walker really is, because he'll be running on very much a propaganda platform going into 2016 and talking about, giving all these talking points of what he did. But what he's really done in the state of Wisconsin is just kind of piece by piece destroyed the public sector, and it's all started back in early 2011 and has continued since.
So many of us were so touched by those displays in the legislative halls. Those people singing, those people gathering. I mean, it was really touching. And how mesmerized do you think the Wisconsin electorate is by this guy?
Well, you know, I'm from Wisconsin. I think that it's a mixed bag. In Madison, Wisconsin, which is a much more liberal, lefty type of place, people aren't all that mesmerized by him at all. But part of this state is because of this whole image that he has of a person being a person that was, quote unquote, to title his book, unintimidated to take on these factions. So it's a pretty smart brand that someone else probably came up with for him for this book that's probably going to lead into his putting his hat in the ring for the 2006 in the run-up to the 2016 elections for the GOP primaries. But it's very much a split issue in this state. You know, obviously, he won the recall election after he originally won the 2010 election, so he's by no means not a popular guy in this state. He won two times, but it's a split legacy that he has, and so that's why it'll be interesting to see how it plays out on a more national level.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks. Gwen, your thoughts on the destruction of public unions?
With Scott Walker, you guys have been doing a lot of talking about him and ALEC and everything. You know, I'm reminded of the incident during all of that going on. Do you remember how somebody punked him on the phone?
Yeah.
And reported him, and he gave forth all of these, yes, oh, yes, I know, thinking he was speaking with the Koch brothers?
Right.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, I think kind of, you know, the more people wake up to what's really being pulled over their eyes by people like Scott Walker and all of the different groups that are coalescing together financially to break the unions, I think waking up to it. And it's the it's the on the ground, feet on the ground people who make up the unions, and they really are. I really think they're stronger than the folks that are buying into the publicity that the mainstream media is pushing out about these GOP, you know, union busting people. And as someone said previously too, they're not just Republicans. There's Democrats who are sticking a stick into trying to put the unions to the side.
Thanks, Gwen. Let me give Tony the last couple minutes here. Tony, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank
brief.
You for including me. I'll be very brief, but thanks for including me. This has really been a thought-provoking discussion. Regarding unions, The big problem that we are facing really is not from Scott Walker. It's from the clay feet of union leaders themselves. You know, the unions have for so long blindly followed the Democratic Party that now they are completely in thrall of it. They are obligated to do whatever it tells them to do. And, you know, what the Democratic Party didn't do was put any money into that recall election against Scott Walker. So
that's
right.
Right
there speaks volumes as to you know, what the real interests of our corporate political parties are. And they are basically, the interest is in giving us a choice between the lesser of two evils, and we have to create a new good and stop accepting the lesser evil.
Thanks so much, everybody. Happy holidays, and we'll talk to you all soon. Thanks so much for joining
us
next
week.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much. Good night.
Good night, everybody. Next week, Women's Rights.
Good night.
Talk to you next week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
It was in the town of Shawnee a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer the same old story told, how the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Guess it's through this world I've wandered. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Good night, friends.